House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, June 17th. Today's an informational meeting, invited testimony only. Sexual assault, forensic evidence, safe kits. And so for an introduction, Kevin Campbell, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I appreciate the opportunity today to come and share regarding an issue that is both national in scope, but is also an issue of importance here in Oregon and one that's grown in importance even during our session. I want to thank and recognize Senator Montes Anderson and Senator Cruz, both who introduced a bill earlier this session that raised the issue of the untested sexual assault kit backlog. And as I mentioned, this is an issue that is not just an Oregon issue, but it's an issue around the United States. And so our opportunity today is to share with you, as a result of the bill's introduction and our commitment to start working together collaboratively on it, that we would come back and have a report on our progress, and I see this as the first installment of that. The first thing I'd like to say, and I maybe say this ad nauseum and you get tired of hearing it, is that I think Oregon is unique. On this issue of untested sexual assault kits, law enforcement at every level, along with our domestic and sexual violence advocacy organizations and leaders and survivors, are here today together. We're here today together on the same page with a commitment to work together with you to solve a problem that we think we have. And we'll go into detail regarding that. I do want to mention that there's three challenges right now that a work group of all the groups I just mentioned are committed to managing. And the first is this. There is around the nation a backlog of test kits that are either in police departments themselves or in forensics labs that have not been tested for a wide variety of reasons. I want to start with one caveat. You'll hear it again, but I want to make sure that I point this out. When we talk about untested sexual assault kits, we are not talking about wanting to test what we call anonymous kits, where a victim has been promised that the kit will not be tested based on their preference. So what we'll talk about today are kits that are not anonymous. These are other kits that for a number of reasons did not move forward for testing. They may reside at the agency or at a forensics lab, but that's what we're talking about today. And we were doing three things as a coalition. The first is this. We're committed to identify and interrogate the reality regarding how many kits do we actually have around the state. That was a part of Senate Bill 563. And so we are in the process right now under the leadership of State Police Superintendent Rich Evans, who you'll hear from in a minute. We're doing that statewide inventory right now. And we will have an exact understanding of how many kits we're talking about. That'll be by the end of June. We should have a pretty complete idea of where that's at. Second of all is that when we talk about this, we're really talking about a shift in policy. The reason we haven't sent kits up till now is because we were working off of a policy. Investigators would make a determination. Could we make a case? Could the case be prosecuted? There were any number of factors that enter into that. But what we've learned through the work of groups nationally like the Joyful Heart Foundation and their work within the backlog is that there are benefits to testing kits that even if they don't today look like they will result in a prosecution. And then, in fact, for victims themselves, it's critical that they know that the kit itself will be tested, that we're taking that process very seriously. It's very important. So that's the second area, is that statewide, making sure that we're aligning our policy, making it best practice. That, frankly, will be tied to the policy that you set as a legislature regarding how we're going to manage and test these kits. And then the third thing, and this is extremely important, is that at every stage, it's really important that we keep victims in mind because a compassionate, survivor-centered approach to what we are doing is critical throughout this process. It's probably most evident when a case, perhaps, after a test is tested now, a kit's tested, years later, suddenly a case becomes real that a survivor had felt like was not going to move forward, well, that can be traumatizing again. And the way we interact with the victim in that case is critically important, and that we have the resources, the support, and the protocols necessary, both with law enforcement and those that care for those victims, that we're aligned, we're working together, and we make sure those resources are available. Before I turn it over now to the first panel, one last thing, and that is that one of the key pieces that you'll hear today is that one of the most important capacity pieces of our discussion is the Oregon State Police forensics capability. As you know, if you looked at an hourglass, the sand at the top of the hourglass is all the work that enforcement, law enforcement does. Identify criminal behavior, make arrests, collect evidence. And then at the bottom, that kind of large container at the bottom is really prosecution. What we do is a result of all of that work in order to send people that are guilty to jail, to determine people who are innocent, all of that work. And in the middle is a choke point. OSP forensics and their capacity to analyze this evidence can become a choke point. And in fact, right now, and I know many of you are very aware of this and you're working on it, being able to expand the capacity of Oregon State Police is critical to making sure that if we're going to send these test kits, not just reduce a backlog, but move forward with a new policy that says we're going to be sending these on into the future. We'll need to make sure that we've got adequate resources there, and we've got folks that are able to kind of tell you why that's the case, and you'll get the full picture. So with that, chairs and members of the committee, thank you for today, and I'm going to turn it over now to the second panel and back to the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Michelle Roland Schwartz, Rod Underhill, Superintendent Evans, and Commander Burke. Can you go in any order, but please identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. All right, good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michelle Roland Schwartz. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a statewide nonprofit organization whose mission is to facilitate and support a victim-centered approach to the prevention of and response to sexual assault in Oregon. We achieve our mission through multidisciplinary collaboration, an effort that you will see reflected in the hearing today and in our approach to address this kit backlog in Oregon as we bring together law enforcement, prosecution, forensic scientists, sexual assault nurse examiners, and advocates. You've heard about the national effort to end the backlog of sexual assault kits already. It's an effort that is addressing our national public safety needs, as DNA evidence provides valuable information about perpetrators. The SAFE kit or medical forensic exam is also an opportunity to address our public health needs. A medical forensic exam is a critical access point for victims to receive comprehensive, specialized health care by a trained examiner, often a sexual assault nurse examiner who you will hear from in the hearing later. We don't want anyone to have to go through a medical forensic exam. However, this is a critical opportunity to mitigate long-term trauma, long-term negative health care needs by providing this level of care, while also documenting injury and collecting valuable evidence. The Oregon legislature recognized the need for all victims to have access to a medical forensic exam when you passed House Bill 2154 in 2007. The bill eliminated the requirement for law enforcement authorization prior to a SAFE kit collection, and it protects the identity of victims who choose to have a SAFE kit collected without making a report to law enforcement. And these kits are commonly referred to as anonymous or Jane Doe kits, as you've heard. In an effort to inventory the number of untested kits in our state, it is important to differentiate between kits that have been designated as anonymous by victims and from kits that have been submitted as part of an act of law enforcement investigations. Victims who consented to an anonymous kit believe that their anonymity will be protected, and until they determine they are ready to report to law enforcement, we should not process those kits as part of our efforts. And last, but certainly not least, it is critical that victims have access to an advocate in the aftermath of a sexual assault, especially in Oregon, where we are second in the country behind Alaska in rates of sexual violence against women. Advocates support victims at the hospital during an exam. They provide valuable information about their rights and options and help them plan for short and long-term safety. Advocates are going to play a critical role in how we notify victims when their untested kits have been processed. As you can imagine, if you're a 19-year-old who's been sexually assaulted and 6 years later your kit has been tested, you might just be getting out of military service. You might be starting a family. You might be, you know, in the middle of a successful career. And now you're notified that this kid has been tested and a perpetrator potentially identified. We want to make sure that how we notify those victims is truly victim-centered and supportive. And so having access to an advocate is going to be really important. We deeply appreciate the commitment from our partners to ensure that practice here in Oregon not only eases victim and community trauma, but also increases reporting and offender accountability. We're very proud to be a part of this statewide effort, to be here with our partners today, and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this issue. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, and members of the committee. I'm George Burke. I am the Commander of Detectives for the Portland Police Bureau. We started taking a look at this problem, really taking a look at national trends, where the rest of the country was going and what they were doing with safe kit testing, sexual assault forensics evidence kit testing. And we quickly realized that we had a significant number of kits that were in our inventory that had never been sent in for testing for one reason or another. And in taking a look at that, we recognized that we needed to do something to help remove some of the discretion that detectives had or officers had in submitting these kits for analysis. And so we started taking a look at what the best practices were and looked at Joyful Heart and actually had some conversations with the Joyful Heart Foundation. And we became aware of a grant opportunity with the Psaki grant through the NIJ, which really allows us to apply for a competitive grant, go through a competitive grant process, where we'd be applying for $2 million to be over the next 3 years. We expect to hear back on our grant application probably in October. But one of the things that we really were able to do if we get the grant is to take a look at our untested kits. So we have already done an inventory of our untested kits, and we know that we have, going back to 1985, 1,931 untested kits out of close to 4,000. The reasons why those were not sent, I don't have the details on that. We can all, you know, speculate as to what reason that was, why they didn't go. But the bottom line is that we recognize that that's really not a real clear victim-centered approach. So in 2014, we established a new policy, new guidelines as to what we would require for submission, understanding that long-term goal would be to remove discretion almost completely so that the kits would be sent to the crime lab for analysis to a lab for analysis, understanding what the impacts are if we start doing that. One of the other things that we did in looking at the grant is not just to look at the untested kits, but it's also to take a look at how do we get to where we won't be in this position again? How do we avoid being at 1,900 kits in the future? And we were looking at putting systems in place for notification of victims, what happens through the process, really setting up hotlines and database information so we can report back to victims as they go through this process. We felt that was very important and was part of the competitive grant process. In looking at what our new policy, the new policy really has increased the number of kits that we submit. It is not where we're submitting every kit at this point, but it certainly has increased the workload and I think has had some negative consequences and impacts on the Oregon State Crime Lab. There are only so many resources. I'm sure you're going to get to hear that several times. The resources on the Oregon State Crime Lab, we don't want to start pushing back other cases that need to be prosecuted or need to be analyzed to move forward with this process. We want to work together collaboratively to figure out how can we do this without having negative impacts on other partner agencies as well as the Oregon State Police. Our current policy really takes a look at the issues of our stranger cases where the victim has absolutely no idea who the suspect was. And then the other two areas we take a look at are submission on cases where consent is not, or where identity is not the issue, and where consent becomes the issue. So we're really looking at, we've increased our number of submissions significantly, which has had an impact on the Oregon State Crime Lab. That really covers the areas that I think we need to cover from the Portland Police Bureau side of things, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Kramer.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Przanski. Thank you for this opportunity, Senators Montes, Anderson, and Thatcher. Thank you for your attendance. Rod Underhill, Multnomah County's District Attorney. The importance of appropriate forensic evaluation of sexual assault forensic examination kits, also known as SAFE kits, as you've heard, cannot be overstated. This evidence is often critical to assisting victims and our communities, public safety, and our general society in holding abusers accountable for acts in areas such as child abuse, child sexual abuse, stranger-on-stranger sexual assault, domestic violence, human trafficking, and other areas. It was last winter, I was having a conversation with a number of national prosecutors or prosecutors from around the country. I had conversations with Cy Vance out of Manhattan, and I'll come back and talk a little bit more about him and a grant that he's offering up that we've participating in. Kim Worthy out of Detroit, and anybody who's had a chance to look at a national conversation learned that they had several thousand of backlogged sexual assault kits, and I spoke with her personally, together with Tim McGinty out of Cleveland, Ohio, and others about this challenge, if you will, that we're seeing across the country and what can we do about it. And I was encouraged in each of those conversations by listening to them last winter with a attitude of, you got to get in and you got to get to work on this. And so I came back to our jurisdiction. I'm summarizing those meetings and those conversations, but I came back and I felt further encouragement. In my own office, brought up the conversation with my management team. We quickly called together a local sheriff and chief's meeting. So my sheriff in Multnomah County, together with our chiefs of police, including Larry O'Day, who, of course, is a chief with Commander Burke's office, Commander Burke and others. And we began having a conversation, do we have untested sexual assault kits in Multnomah County, for example, that we need to get to work on? So I was encouraged to learn that that conversation with Portland police had already begun outside of my calling this meeting together, and that they were starting to look at this. We were able to quickly put together and put it on front burner for all of us in the early part of this year. And I'm encouraged to know in concert with other people beginning to ask the questions as well. And identified some work that we need to be doing. And the further encouragement was a can-do attitude. That brought us out to reaching out to system partners, some of which are sitting to my left and my right, and numerous conversations with Superintendent Evans about a desire to not just Multnomah County and take care of our business, which we want to take care of, but also let's talk about the rest of the state. It was with that thought in mind that when the opportunity came to apply for a different grant than you heard Commander Burke talk about, the BJA grant, there is a separate grant run out of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, Cy Vance's office. I met with, as I mentioned, I touched bases with him, but I also talked with Maggie Wolk, who's the program director for an opportunity out of Manhattan. Essentially, that's called the New York County District Attorney, a Sexual Assault Kit Backlog Elimination Program. My office took the lead in submitting a application of intent back in the early part of this year essentially saying we're going to intend to apply for up to $2 million to assist with backlog testing. We then began some legwork, and that's where system partners were included, conversations. Ultimately, I'll jump ahead and say we met our June 1st deadline, of course. The submission is in, and it includes partners from our jurisdiction in Multnomah County, but also Marion County and Lane County. Alex Gardner was, of course, raised his hand when I called him and said, do you want to participate with us in our application for up to $2 million from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to assist? Of course, Superintendent Evans has supplied a letter of support as well, and that's part of our package that has now been submitted, and I'm very optimistic that we stand good odds of getting some assistance in this area. Now, why does it matter? Why does it matter? Why do today forward and backlog analysis matter? And I'll take a moment to talk about some a real-life situation to bring this home, I hope, to many people. So on December 13th of 2001, I received a call in my office of a homicide that had occurred. A young woman named Melissa Bittler had left her home at about 7:30 a.m. that morning. She was walking to the bus on her way to school. She'd gotten out of her door and she'd gotten across the street before she was at that time abducted by, at the time, an unknown man. He had drug her behind the neighbor's home where he sexually assaulted her and murdered her. He strangled her to death. Several months later, as we were working on the case, several developments occurred. One that occurred right away. Melissa Bittler, the crime scene was analyzed. Her remains were taken to the state medical examiner. Medical professionals, the state medical examiner, the deputy was there and did a sexual assault kit examination, called for assistance from CARES Northwest to make sure that that examination was done perfectly. We received a sexual assault forensic examination kit that was hastily sent to Rich Evans's office. Tom Barnes is behind me. He and I both remember this case where members of his office worked on it, Terry Kuhn specifically. Within short order, relatively, we received a DNA profile. We knew that we had forensic evidence of who was the killer and the person who sexually assaulted Melissa Bittler. What we didn't have was his name. What followed then was several months of hard work by teams of detectives and prosecutor's office and citizen involvement, people wanting answers to this question of this young child that was walking to school and had been abducted and murdered. What we learned rather quickly was there was another 1997 sexual assault of a young girl walking to school who had been abducted, taken behind a home, and sexually assaulted. I'm going to use her initials, AK. AK survived her attack. We had forensic evidence from that assault, and we knew that it was the same person. What many people didn't know was that simultaneously detectives were combing the unsolved sexual assault in the Portland metropolitan region to see if we had any other cases that met the MO, if you would, because we needed identification, we needed description. Who was this person? Is this an older person, younger person? Any number of different things. We had some guidance. What we found were two cases. The victims, JC and MH, had also been sexually assaulted in similar circumstances, taken into a backyard, sexually assaulted, survived both of their attacks. Their cases and those forensic examination kits had not been submitted to the state crime lab for analysis. The MO fit. Detectives grabbed those, of course, those evidence kits, submitted them, and they were right. It was the same person. We now had a serial sex offender who had turned the corner into a murderer. Unfortunate for us, before we were able to determine what his name in fact was, he committed another act of sexual violence against another woman. SB are her initials. She survived her attack despite faking her own death. He was charged with and convicted of aggravated murder in the course of a sexual assault. He thought he had killed her. She survived. She faked her death. She was able to provide us a glimpse into who this person might be that had committed his offense against her. DNA was obtained relative to that case and analyzed, and we saw a match across the board on what turned out to be several years worth of sexual assault to include this homicide. I say with a degree of significant confidence that absent having prosecuted that case, it took between 2 and 3 months to try. The jury ultimately convicted LaDon Stevens, was his name. Convicted LaDon Stevens of aggravated murder and sentenced him to, and he was sentenced ultimately to life in prison with, if I remember right, I didn't double check today, but about 1,000 months consecutive, it was 1,000 years, maybe. A little rusty. He got a true life and a lot more. That evidenced the extreme severity of the nature of his crimes. And absent forensic evidence and the capabilities that exist for both testing today forward and the backlog capacity that we need to address and take care of for victims such as CA and MH, whose cases would not have been solved but for efforts by detectives and that backlog testing, we would not have been able to solve those crimes. We would have probably been able to solve that subset, the last one, the one involving victim SB. But the others, I say with a degree of, I knew the case inside and out, of course. We would not have been able to solve it absent the hard work by State Crime Lab, Terry Coons, and others. So the significance of this is difficult to articulate. It is extreme. It is appropriate for us to get today forward protocols that are aggressive, expansive, and as inclusive as we reasonably, responsibly can, together with looking at our backlog. And also, because how many other CAs and MHs exist out there that may result in subsequent prosecutions on their behalf. It was commented, and I'll wrap it up, it was commented by Michelle, that the actually and others, I think Kevin did as well, the impact on victims. I can tell you firsthand that after several years of those victims, MH and CA, believing their cases had essentially gone nowhere, and they hadn't gone anywhere. But when we did take them off the shelf and did examine them and did see what we saw, there was a lot of work with those young ladies to build their confidence back up in order to empower them, strengthen them enough to endure a jury trial that was closely watched and with significant impacts. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Evans, and I'm superintendent of the Oregon State Police. Obviously, a lot of this discussion leads to the Oregon State Police Crime Lab. When I started hearing from our partners that they had these untested kits, I also learned about the Senate Bill 563 and the requirement that it basically created a law that we would do this work. I knew through our partnerships that we have in the Public Safety Committee, we didn't need a statute to do that. So we began meeting as a group right away to say, is there an issue? How can we solve this issue? And so I appreciate you bringing that forward, but I'm hoping in the future that we will show that through our committed partnerships, we can do this work and we can get to it in a timely manner. So the first thing that came to mind when I began to hear about the number of kits is the capacity of the State Police Crime Lab. As you know, we're responsible for 36 counties, and frankly, the DNA unit, which you'll hear from Tom Barnes, is working at capacity now. We're working on property crimes, person crimes, including murder, and we prioritize everything that comes in the door. These are cases that have trial dates. These are cases that have real victims, and we continue to work on that on a daily basis. Cases come in, cases go out, and they do very good work, but it isn't something, as you'll hear later, that we can train somebody to do in an instant. It takes almost a year to train a new DNA scientist to do this work, and it is a lengthy process. I'm going to have Director Barnes talk about the process and how long it takes. So when we started talking about these grants, I started worrying about capacity because we're already doing grants. We're already working on the DNA backlog grants from the federal government. So any additional grants, our folks wouldn't be able to work 24/7, basically. So we started talking about how, as a group, we could work to this. One of the solutions is outsourcing some of the kits to other forensic labs. And the grants allow that, but I want to call to your attention that if we do that, we also will have to enter an agreement with that lab and monitor that lab so we can keep the lab accreditation for the Oregon State Police, which is extremely important to us. There's initial cost for the outsourcing, and they will do the DNA analysis, bring it back to us, and then we have additional work to enter into the combined, the CODIS database, which is our national DNA database. And that's about 5 hours of work for us, even if it's outsourced. So obviously, the first thing I'm worried about is capacity. How am I going to meet this need when I've heard Portland has 1,900 kits when we can only do so many at a time? So we started working with our partners, applying for the grants, speaking with you, and outreaching to you to try to solve this issue in a long-term solution. What I don't want to have happen is this is a continuing conversation for us, at least I believe, in law enforcement. As we change our practices going forward, we continue to make sure that we work hard to keep the backlog down, and this, instead of just solving the problem this time, continuing to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And what I will tell you is we have committed partnerships. We're all here together, and we're committed to doing that. My fear, and has been from day one as I talk to my partners, is we still have to meet the ongoing needs of the public safety system in Oregon on a daily basis. And so working through our partnerships, I believe we're heading down that road. I believe we can get there. And I just want everybody to know I appreciate everybody at this table, the people you're going to hear, for coming to the table. Portland Police Bureau has been a great partner, George, and Chief O'Day, where communications weren't in the past. They're open now, and law enforcement's working to solve this problem. I know that in the near future, you hear from Director Barnes about the length and the process and the complexity of a DNA examination and how, you know, for us to maintain our certification and do it right, the process can't be shortcutted. And so the fact of the matter is the work is there. We will continue to prioritize it for our public safety partners, and we're committed to solving this problem. If you have any other questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
I'd just like to say thank you for doing the outreach you've done to enable all the departments to get into your crime lab with the least problems. Senator Ramona Sanderson.
Thank you. Just a quick question regarding your staff at the Oregon State Police. How many forensics lab, are they officers or are they scientists?
So they're scientists, and so we have them broken out into a specific Tom's going to kill me, but specific disciplines. For a DNA examination, you have to have the biology folks who work on the kit to identify the presence of DNA, and then your DNA scientist. And off the top of my head, Tom will correct me, I believe there's 16 biologists and 18 DNA scientists currently. It's really close to that right
and
now.
Just one further. And then how many do you process in a year?
I know
is
that
Tom going to talk about that.
Tom may not be able to have it off the top of his head, but I have that data, and I will get that to you. We have looked at that to try to figure out how long it would take us to work on the backlog, so I have that, but I don't have it off the top of my head.
Thank you, Chairman.
Rich, I'm going to start with you. Since you've taken the leadership one, I want to thank you, as Chair Barker has, as to kind of trying to figure out what we're actually dealing with on a statewide basis. So thank you very much for that. And I agree that I really do believe this is a, call it an internal issue that needs to be worked within the system that we have. So I know that you're going to continue from our previous discussions to see this through. Regarding, I guess Tom may give us some information as to the time it takes for processing. As most of you probably know, I've committed to a work group that's going to be looking at the statute of limitations on first-degree sex crimes. Even though we've doubled it to 12, I do believe there's a discussion that needs to occur to see what, if anything else, we need to do. And one of the concerns I had in making certain that we had all the information was what, if anything, we can take from the rape kit review investigation. Is there stuff that we need to take in consideration, such as if we have with the backlog, how long is it going to take to process? Should we be factoring that into what the length of the statute of limitations to take care of that? Also, I think it's important to understand, and I'm not sure, what is in a rape kit that may be non-DNA that could play into the non-DNA side of cases, because as you all know, we already have no statute of limitations where there is DNA evidence. So this is something that I will be important for us to have for this work group. And I'm not sure if you can comment on that. Maybe Tom will be a better person to do that when he comes up, since he's kind of in the field on a daily basis. I'll save some of those responses for Tom. I just get those on the record. And Rod, I'm interested in the funding the New York DA's office.
Yes.
What is their reason or rationale for putting grants out to other jurisdictions? I'm real curious about that.
Well, I can pass on the conversations that I had with DA Vance and his assistant in charge of this, Maggie Walk, about the uniqueness, if you will, of a local district attorney's office, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, offering up a $35 million grant opportunity for opportunities around the country. That's a lot of money,
yeah.
And typically resigned for federal government or private nonprofits, right? D.A. Vance is very personally committed to this philosophy of a very aggressive sexual assault kit examinations day forward and backlog. And so he has a personal philosophy of wanting to get that done, and he was taking leadership in his local jurisdiction. He also has a very aggressive forfeiture unit within his office, and his office did criminal prosecution work, and resulting in some very, very significant forfeiture recoveries on behalf of his office. So that's where I'm summarizing. Yeah. This money opportunity came along. He saw no greater opportunity, in his opinion, than to help the rest of the country in a very benevolent way, to make this an opportunity for everybody to help with his philosophies and the kind of the really the nation's kind of lens on this. And so that we are available to apply for eligible, I should say, up to $2 million for the kit testing. And the reason I say it that way is it's not for prosecutors. Mm-hmm. It's not for prosecutor work at all. Zero will go to our review, because there is a lot of work that will go into this in addition to just, and I don't mean to say just the testing, but in addition to the testing. None of it will go to Portland Police Bureau, Sheriff's Office, or any other law enforcement agency. It is simply for the state crime lab and or this third-party opportunity that we may have to outsource, as touched on by Superintendent Evans. And we've had those deep conversations. I don't know if you want me to keep talking and go into that. But
let me just, if I could, please follow up on one of the things I'm concerned when we talk about outsourcing is the chain of custody.
Yes,
and I'm not sure if it'd be best for this panel or another question for Tom.
No, I can talk about that to some degree. Simply put, we share that concern. One of the concerns is less so much the chain of custody. I think we'll be very careful and thorough with respect to making sure that we have established a chain of custody for purposes of downstream litigation if that becomes appropriate. In addition, I'll add, though, that if we outsource this sexual assault kit to, you know, pick a state, I'll just pick California. They're relatively close, but I could also pick, Florida. Our primary witness is in that jurisdiction as well, the person who did the testing. So that will, as a practical matter, oftentimes fall on the local jurisdiction, meaning if it's me and I'm working with the Portland Police Bureau on a particular case where we did receive significant evidence that results in us going to grand jury and subsequently on to trial, there is going to incur some local costs to bringing that witness or witnesses, plural, back who had done that testing. And establishing, if appropriate and necessary, that chain of custody analysis. Now, we're all putting that on the T scale. And understanding that, we are committed to, we got to figure out a way to get this done. And so that's where I say there is a can-do attitude, not just nationally by people that I've touched on, but I think here locally. We see that. We got to be responsible. Relative to recognizing those expenses and being minimizing costs where we can, while at the same time looking at we got to get this done kind of attitude.
Okay. And the last one I have, and this is back to the superintendent, since there's probably more in your overview, do you have a time frame of when you think your rape kit investigation work group is going to have the information you need to be able to report back what 563 was asking for?
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, I set a date of June 30th of 2015, more aggressive than what was in the bill, to get it back to us so that the work group could analyze that.
Right.
Preliminarily, we have, I would say, about a third of those agencies have already reported to us, and the number is lower than what I personally expected. And so once we get that number, the information that you're requesting, I will forward to you, but we will have a better idea on the time frame, how many resources we'll need, and to look at those. Obviously, we're going to have to triage those cases once we get them, right? There's going to be additional work once we identify them, but we felt it was important. by June 30th to know the scope, the entire scope of the problem, and then we will dig in deeper as the group moves forward.
That sounds great. I hope that maybe they, let's say, the secondary research that needs to be done can be completed by the end of the summer, end of August. My goal is for the statute of limitations work group to start in September, planning for the February session. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next call, Patty Kenyon, Deputy Chief Belshaw, and Director Barnes.
Good afternoon.
Go in the order, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Przemski, and members of the committee. My name is Patty Kenyon. I am a sexual assault nurse examiner, or SANE nurse. I manage the coordinator for the sexual assault program out of Samaritan Health Services. As a sexual assault nurse, I received approximately 120 hours of additional training to provide a medical forensic exam to patients who identify as a sexual assault victim. We've talked a lot about what is a kit. I just wanted you to know this is what we're talking about. Small, it's not very impressive, but it obviously contains a huge amount of information. Kits are primarily collected out of hospitals, student health services, correctional institutions where SANEs are located. My primary function is not, as I see it, is not the kit. It's to provide medical care, both physical and emotional care for that survivor, patient, victim, whatever label, according to the discipline we're with, puts on that person. When a patient comes in to the hospital or clinic, they come in to make sure that they're okay and that they have not caught any diseases. Very rarely do I hear, I want a kit collected, unless they have spent extensive time with law enforcement. Advocates do a great job of helping them understand what it is they're coming in for, but most do not truly understand what that exam is going to involve. It is a very lengthy...
Can I ask you to speak up a little? I'm having trouble hearing.
It is a very lengthy exam. It is a very intrusive exam. Frequently, I spend 4 to 6 hours with a patient. It involves asking them about their past medical history. That's the easy part. And then we move on to what has happened to them. I don't think there's anybody in the room that wants to discuss their last sexual encounter, whether it's something they were a willing participant in or when they were violated, when control of their body was taken away from them. As far as collecting evidence, I swab where their DNA may be, which is usually the mouth that I'm swabbing, and I swab where there may be blood, semen, saliva, or skin cells, hence the long, invasive history taking. A big part of what I do is to inform the patient of what it is, what their options are, from having a kit collected to doing that anonymously or working with law enforcement. Anonymous, means their name is on the front of the kit or it is not on the front of the kit. The name is provided to law enforcement or not provided. As far as the kit goes, everything is done exactly the same. The other part that I do is provide that medical care as far as preventing infections, preventing pregnancy, if that is something that they would like to have done, and providing resources in the community for both emotional care and their follow-up physical care. Patients have the right to have this provided to them without cost. That's through the Department of Justice, the Crime Victims Compensation. However, it does not pay for everything, such as HIV prophylaxis, and other medical care as needed. A big part of what I tell patients is your kit will not be opened if you do not initiate that investigation. I hope that continues. That's very important, very near and dear to my heart. So I thank you for your time, allowing me to come and speak to you. It's an important, very important topic.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Brzezanski. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today and your commitment to addressing this important issue. For the record, my name is Steve Belshaw. I'm Deputy Chief of Police for the Salem Police Department. I've been a law enforcement officer for 26 years, and I've been an instructor in the investigation and prosecution of sexual assault, both on the state and national level, since 2003, in dealing with these issues, both with the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force and the International Association of Chiefs of Police Violence Against Women Leadership Institute. As I go around the country and I talk about this and I go around the state and talk about this, people ask me, and law enforcement ask me, how did we get in this situation? There are a number of reasons how we got in this situation, but one of them involves the discretion that officers have in dealing with these situations. So when we do these investigations, we talk to the DA's office and we talk to them about is this case prosecutable? Can we likely win in this case? How willing is our victim to participate in the prosecution? What evidence do we have? Do we believe the evidence or believe the victim? And sometimes we let our personal opinions get in the way of that. And then we look at is the identity of the suspect in question. And so cases where the defense is not I didn't do it, but it was consensual, most of the time we have not been sending these kits. We've been mindful of resources of the State Police Crime Lab, of the courts and the systems, and so we have chosen not to send those kits to be tested. And we're finding that we should have been testing those kits, that we should have been doing that. Because what we have been missing out on is while I have a case with a named offender, but I don't know that I can win this case in court, and I don't send that kit, my kit being sent could solve Clackamas County or Multnomah County or Linn County's unsolved case, because the studies have shown over and over again that these offenders offend over and over again. They have multiple victims. And so we need to emphasize that we need to hold offenders accountable, and we need to send every kit to identify these offenders who are moving across our state. And so as we talk about these things on a national level, the best practices that are being discussed right now are guidelines that would say a kit should be submitted within 10 days after it being seized and should be tested within 30 days of it being submitted. And those are the things that are being discussed. Now, when we look at those types of guidelines, there are some ramifications to doing that. And as you've heard, one of the biggest impacts is on our partners, the State Police Crime Lab. And so we have a backlog of cases where we can solve cases and hold offenders accountable that haven't been held accountable yet, but they only have limited resources. And so increasing those resources is a necessity. And I can ask that. I don't work for a State Police Crime Lab, and my funding doesn't come from the state. But so we need those resources there, and we don't need to misplace other resources. DNA and the use of DNA to solve crimes is only going to increase, and the crime lab's ability to help us solve those crimes is increasing, and so their resources need to increase. But as we also need to be prepared for other impacts that are going to affect us as a community. It's going to affect my investigators, as we open more cases and we have to track down victims from old cases, as we have to track down offenders, we have to track down witnesses, those kinds of things. So there's that impact. There's going to be an impact on the courts and on the prosecutor's office as we prosecute more cases and we submit more cases. And as you've heard, there's going to be an impact on our advocates, that we need more advocates to go out and contact these victims that have been out of the loop for years, and we need to deal with that. And so there are a lot of things that we need to deal with and how we've gotten to this case. But understand that this is not just about clearing all the kits and the backlog off of our shelves. This is sending a message. Our communities have said very loud and clear, sexual assault needs to be a priority. That's how we got here. That's how we've found that we have these backlogs, that these cases need to be a priority, and we need to send the message also to our victims, we believe you, and we need to send the message to the offenders that you will be held accountable for your bad behavior. And so I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, and thank you for helping us send this message to our communities.
Thank you, Chief.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker, Chairman Pazanski, and other members of this committee. My name is Thomas Barnes, and I'm the Laboratory Director for the Oregon State Police Portland Metro Laboratory, which is up in Clackamas. I've been employed by the Forensic Services Division for 27 years and have been the lab director for about the last seven. I was asked by Superintendent to come and talk about the operational aspects related to the impact of sexual assault evidence kits at the crime laboratory. The Forensic Service Division is an accredited forensic laboratory system that provides forensic services to the whole range of the criminal justice community. The Forensic Service Division laboratories currently triage incoming biology cases, which include sexual assault kits, into two primary groups. One is person crimes, and the other is property crimes. With person crimes taking priority over property crimes. Sexual assault cases are obviously against crime against the person, so they are a priority for the laboratory system. The prioritization of person crimes is based upon, one, the fact is the suspect in imminent danger to the public based upon investigative information. Is it a public safety hazard? That's our primary concern. Secondly, court dates. We are dealing with a lot of rushes for courts because of the fact we have a backlog, we're not getting to these things quickly, so we end up doing a lot of rush work on these things. And lastly is on the submission date, first in, first out, as far as that goes. The submitting agency decides what sexual assault cases, what cases as a whole, will be submitted to the laboratory system through one of the five regional laboratories. Sexual assault cases are screened at the local laboratory by analysts that is trained in the biology processing section. This initial processing of sexual assault kit involves a review of the investigative reports. We're looking at what's probative, what's the best evidence to look for. Examination of the contents of the kits. If you open the kit up, what you would see, there's a series of slides, swabs, and envelopes in that kit, and they're used for different body areas. In addition to that, we do documentation of what we have, documentation of what the examination was, and then we'll issue a report based upon that. This is all for our accreditation and so that it's legally defensible. Screening of sexual assault kits takes approximately 8 hours on an average, just for the kit. Sometimes on sexual assault cases, we get bedding, we get clothing. That's going to add a lot more time depending on how much other stuff we have to screen. We currently have 17 scientists assigned to the biology processing section statewide. Approximately 75% of all sexual assault kits received by the Forensic Services Division are forwarded to the DNA section for analysis. DNA analysis is conducted exclusively at the Portland lab. It's the only place that we have it. It's easier to control, and it's a space hog as far as that goes. We have 16 scientists assigned to the DNA section currently. DNA analysis involves the extraction of the DNA material off of whatever matrix it is swab, clothing, cigarette, but whatever it happens to be. Extraction of that, quantitation, how much is there? Amplification, where we make multiple copies of the DNA, and then the analysis of that through the instrumentation that we have. Once that's done, if we have results, if those results can be uploaded into CODIS, we upload those results in the CODIS. Not every case can be uploaded in the CODIS. There are specific requirements for what is involved in the CODIS as far as being done at. DNA analysis of a sexual assault kit generally takes between 10 and 11 hours for a two-item, two-standard kit. So you've got a couple of swabs, a couple of standards, victim suspect, victim boyfriend, if there was recent consensual sex. But it takes about that length of time. If YSTR testing is done, this is going to take about an additional 5 hours. YSTR testing is DNA that's on the male chromosome. And as a result, it allows us in cases where we have a mixture of a lot of female DNA with some male DNA, we can eliminate the female DNA and focus on the male DNA, which is what we're looking for. All of our scientists are highly trained in their respective discipline. Shifting employees between sections is not possible without completion of the required discipline-specific training, which can take 6 to 12 months, depending upon where they're coming from. All of our scientists are required to be competency tested at the completion of this training and take an annual proficiency test, two of them for DNA. Training for new employees in the DNA discipline is approximately a year. A trained biology processing analyst can analyze approximately 135 sexual assault kits per year if they're not working any other types of cases. A trained DNA analyst can work approximately 130 sexual assault cases per year, again, if they're not working any other cases. Currently, the DNA unit has more than 1,150 cases backlogged. This is a mixture of property crimes and person crimes, and receives more cases generally on a monthly basis than we put out. Every once in a while, we get a nice month where we actually dig into the backlog, but generally speaking, we're going up. We are currently using federal grant money to fund two full-time positions and also fund DNA overtime, and the DNA overtime is equivalent to 1.2 FTE. The Forensic Service Division also uses general fund overtime money for biology work and potentially hair work that leads into DNA testing as well. Some of the things that were talked about a little bit earlier had to do with outsourcing. Biology processing, the screening portion of the kits, and DNA analysis can both be outsourced to a private laboratory. However, private laboratories cannot do CODIS entry. It's a government program, and they don't have access to it. So what they would do is provide the data, which would come back to us. So what we would have to do prior to outsourcing was we would have to deal with setting up a contract with a vendor. We have to take those samples because we're taking control of those. So we will go through and take those and send them off. We have to go through and train on their protocols because their protocols could be different than ours. We have to make sure that they're up to the standards to enter into CODIS. So there's a lot of work related to that. It is estimated for every case we send out for DNA analysis as an outsource, there's about 5 hours worth of our time, analyst-wise, which will be all involved in case preparation, DNA technical review, and uploading and reporting in CODIS if it actually gets to that. These costs are on top of the initial costs related to procuring a contract, conducting an on-site visit, which is required, and our staff training, which is involved in this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. On victim impact, I'll bring to Tracy.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, please. Yeah,
just really quick. I'm very concerned on why we are entrenched in that only the state police can data enter into CODIS. I would think that people would want to start, since this is a nationwide program, start thinking outside of the box and looking at really training local labs. Has any thought been given to this?
The CODIS program is a federal program. They create the rules. These are not our rules. We're not saying they can't do this. This is the FBI and their program related to this. And it's just that they want to control. They're very careful about what gets entered into CODIS. They want to make sure there's no victims entered, no boyfriends entered. It has to be basically from the perpetrator is what you're doing. And so at this point in time, it has not been opened up to a private company. So they would do the testing for the results, and then those results would come back to us. We'd verify the quality control was correct, and we would enter that into CODIS and follow up with subsequent reports if we get a hit.
It's the unfortunate part that we have with a lot of federal programs.
Oh, I know. I'm a nurse. I know from the healthcare point of view.
Yeah, it's not our criteria, ma'am.
Senator Thatcher?
Yes, thank you. You showed us what the kit looks like. I appreciate that. But I was curious because I had heard of cases where there wasn't, like the perpetrator was very clever, didn't leave behind DNA, but did have there was other evidence. How's that handled? Is that part of the kit? Is that handled separately? I mean, like a stick and a mask, things like that?
Potentially, yes. A lot of times the kit will come in through the hospital, from the police agency. But like I said, sometimes we'll get clothing because there's no information related in the kit that may be beneficial, but maybe there was the sexual activity occurred on a bed or, you know, something along those lines. Or it's been a long period of time since the assault occurred. And so maybe the underwear is a better place to actually get semen if there's flow. And it may not be no longer in a vaginal cavity. And so as a result, we're looking at all that. There are also hairs that are collected. We do pubic hair combings. What we're doing is looking for a hair that is not similar to the victim, that is dissimilar to the victim, so that we can take that hair and then we can look at it. And if it's got a correct root, we're able to actually do DNA on the root of that. As far as that goes, if there's swabs or there's some generic swabs in there, was there kissing on the neck or, you know, was there a breast swab taken because of where the assailant had actually attacked the victim and where they had touched the victim? So there is other things that is included as far as the kit goes.
And again, As I mentioned, more and more DNA, and the crime lab has been very aggressive in dealing with this. So they've been giving us and testing things of aggressive handling. So when a victim in strangulation cases where the suspect strangles the victim, swabbing the neck, we can get the suspect's DNA off of there. Suspects that are grabbing victims' clothes and pulling them tight, we've been able to get the DNA off of those types of things too. So it's more than the kits. And so while they've described what it takes to process the kits, we're having more and more opportunities to identify suspects and hold them accountable as well.
Anything further?
And just one other quick question. I know, at least in healthcare, we're always asking for the feds for waivers, and we get waivers. Has anything been done with regarding asking the feds for a waiver?
Be honest with you, I don't know. I haven't been involved with the administration of this program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel. Brenda Tracy, B.B. Beltran, Director Beltran, and Jason Myers, please. And again, you can go in any order you'd like, but please identify yourself for the record.
Get it out of the way.
Chair Barker and Chair Brzezanski, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Bibi Beltran. I am the Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services, SAS. SAS is a nonprofit organization that provides support services to survivors of sexual assault, their partners, friends, and family. We do a variety of services, including a 24/7 crisis line, 24/7 crisis response, long-term support. So we try to do it all.
Bibi, could you move the mic more directly? Yeah, thanks.
All right. So I'm here today to talk about the advocate's role when it comes to the SAFE exam. As an advocate, one of the things that we try to do is to be honest with survivors. In fact, that's part of being survivor-centered. Being survivor-centered, you know, we've talked about it a lot here, it means that we give them accurate information. So we're not trying to provide false hope or mislead them in any way, shape, or form. So when it comes to meeting survivors for the exam, there's a variety of ways that SAS advocates can do that. Sometimes it involves a survivor presenting at our drop-in center and discussing the options with an advocate, and then we go to the ER. Or somebody calls on the crisis line and kind of talks about something that happened to maybe themselves or somebody that they know, and we arrange either transportation or meet them at the ER. Or in our county, we have protocols as part of our sexual assault response team, the SART, where the medical facilities in our area call us. So hopefully at triage. However, sometimes survivors don't indicate sexual assault until they're in an exam room for lots of different reasons. So when we get to the hospital, hopefully it's before any of the systems pieces have happened, just because it's easier for us to get there and explain all the options as opposed to when the train's already left the station and then we're kind of having to backfill. So one of the things that makes it really difficult for me as an advocate is to really bust those myths. So because of these great shows on TV like CSI, the general population kind of has a skewed version of what actually happens in the criminal justice system. So a big part of what we do is try to bridge that disconnect between reality and perception. So when survivors go through this extremely intrusive exam, as Patty Kenyon talked about, they have this expectation that this kit is going to be tested. They really do. So it's so hard for advocates to be as unbiased as possible and just present the facts when the facts are so dire, which is, as Steve Belshaw indicated, if the perpetrator is known, the likelihood that kit will be tested goes away, and then it goes back to consent. So we're asking survivors, who usually in an acute crisis situation, to go through this invasive exam and to participate in this process, and then the kit doesn't get tested. So I feel that the system is flawed. However, I know that this group of folks here, we all agree with that, and we're all invested in making the system work better for survivors. One of the ways that I think that can be improved as far as my work goes relates to the victim notification. I think it's wonderful that every SAFE kit would be tested. I think that's great. However, I do have concerns about folks who have been disengaged from the whole process for quite some time being notified. So I think that, you know, there's the potential to re-traumatize folks without some type of warning any way to kind of articulate what to expect. You know, now that the kit has been tested, what next? I think that to avoid the trauma, or to mitigate the trauma, I should say, we should have a very thoughtful, consistent response that's statewide. That way, I don't have to say, I don't know what will happen. It just depends. This is a critical issue for survivors. Critical. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would just say, when I first started in police work, we didn't have rape victim advocates. They came on soon after that. It made a huge, huge difference, especially for the victim.
Thank you.
My name is Brenda Tracy. Thank you, Chair Barker and Chair Brzezanski, for having me and members of the committee. So I actually testified for Senate Bill 563 when it first came up this session. And I think what happened, I think we kind of all agreed, myself and a lawyer that I work with, we started delving into the severity of the backlog and funding and grants. And I think it just was such a big issue that we decided to send it to a work group, which I'm actually thankful for, because I think with a work group, we can really be thoughtful about all of the issues pertaining to this backlog issue and testing. I had this done, and I know that it looks like a little envelope, like it's really not a big deal, but this is a life. I mean, this means it's the first time I've seen my story diminished to this. And even today, it's really upsetting that this is what it is. But, you know, when I was gang raped by four men and I wanted to pursue justice, I had a rape kit done. And I can speak to how invasive that process is. It's very long. And it is traumatizing. What is also traumatizing is the idea that after going through such an invasive process that the kit would not be tested or processed. And in my case, was actually destroyed. It was not tested, it was not processed, and it was destroyed before the statute of limitations was even up. So I have had trauma after trauma after trauma after trauma happen, which is why I sit before you today. Because I'm not the only person who's been through this trauma. I'm not the only woman who has presented at an emergency room to have a rape kit done and then had to sit on a shelf or be destroyed. Anonymous kits, I agree with everyone. They should not be tested right away. I think that's a whole nother issue that we could talk about at the work groups. But women like me who move forward that want justice, I believe that it is awful that these kits are not tested. It pains me that there's such a huge backlog. But as other people have said, all of us are here together today to try to remedy this situation. Multiple states have ended their backlog. Multiple states have legislation in place and policies in place where they test the kits within 30 days. Like you said, there's states that are giving money to other states to test these kits. There's more funding available than what's even been talked about today. At the work group, I can bring Jacqueline Swanson, another advocate, who can talk about money that is there for temporary employees, for CODIS, and for testing. There's multiple things that we can do, and we can think outside the box, like Senator Montes Anderson had said. So I think it's just a matter of having the work group and really digging into this issue, and I think we can address all of the issues everyone has brought up. Being myself kind of being at the forefront as far as the media goes and the name and the face on this issue, I will continue to do so. But I want you all to understand that my goal for Oregon as a state is to present a united front, survivors, legislation, state police, everyone, for all of us to get together as a state and set an example for the rest of the nation, really, that you can not only deal with this issue, but you can also be victim-centered. And we can do it right. We have other states we can look at and see, what have you done? How did that work out for you? You ended your backlog. How did you do it? Where was the money? How was notification dealt with? We're in a great position to do a really great thing here in our state, and I plan to do what I can to be involved in that. So that's kind of my stance on it, but I look forward to the work group, and I look forward to working with all agencies involved. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming down again.
Thank you. I'm here again.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm a Marion County Sheriff, and I'm going to keep my comments really short. I just hope that you picked out the three important themes in today's groups that have testified before you. The first one is that there is a large work group of collaborative partners working on this issue to identify the untested sexual assault kits and then address those untested kits. Secondly, in law enforcement, we're really going to focus on creating good policies, strong policies, best practice policies around sexual assault kits and how they're handled. And then thirdly, we're focusing on victims, and we're making sure that we do not impact them any more than they have already been impacted with these investigations. So thank you for the opportunity today to testify in front of you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Sheriff. Anybody have any questions? Chairman Brzezinski.
Bibi, one question regarding the rape kits, where it comes into play with a known assailant. Mm-hmm. I got the impression that you may think that those kits as well should be tested, and I'm just kind of get your perspective as an advocate why you would think that would be appropriate, knowing if we know who the assailant is, and what purpose do you feel that it would serve for the survivor in having the kit actually tested?
I think several things. I think validation, you know, some type of value to their life and their experience. I think it's been my experience so oftentimes that the systems, you know, it's not really built to address this issue. And so there are very narrow ways that survivors can seek justice. And, you know, one of the things as an advocate I talk about with survivors is to, you know, kind of separate the outcome of a criminal justice process from the healing process, because so often there's, you know, it's not going to do this. So I think that it sounds simple, but I think that the impact it can have on the community, you know, that the system cares, I think that would go a long way.
Okay. Now, these questions are more to put stuff on the record so we understand the perspective. So when we're in the work group, we have the reasons why we might want to advocate for that to occur. So thank you.
Chair Brzezinski.
Can I follow that?
Expand on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And I thought I heard somebody say, well, the attacker said, well, yes, we had sex, but it was consensual. So the DNA to prove what already happened seemed to be superfluous when there's a huge battle.
Answer that.
The one other thing they said earlier, too, so then that goes into the data bank, and boom, you have somebody who...
That's true.
They find
the
guilty party
that
is unknown from a different...
Yeah, not only had consensual sex with this one, but with five others who didn't agree with consensual either. Yeah, that makes sense.
Representative Greenlick and Chair Brzezinski, to kind of further add to that, 80%, if not more, of perpetrators are known to the victim. That's normally the case. Yeah, when you have the DNA and you put it in a database, many times you're going to string together many consensual acts of sex amongst many people. And we've seen many of those cases recently in the media. There was a high-profile case with an NFL player, Darren Sharper, who went across state lines and was drugging and raping women. These women were making reports, and nothing was being entered into the database. Eventually, one detective in L.A., said, you know, I heard about him another time and looked into it, and he was just recently convicted of 9 rapes and is in jail. So, and not only that, but we're connecting to other crimes. Normally, a serial rapist is also a criminal, and they commit other crimes. So public safety, it's a public safety issue, and I think you can prevent other crimes if we enter them into the database and test them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in today and testifying. We appreciate it.
Thank you, everyone.
Else is coming for the committee, we will stay in the journey.